The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We are now entering a different sphere. In fact, this sphere is so different from what we've been doing till now, you won't even need a text. I'm willing to bet that everybody here can remember our text by heart. It's the same in both sets of commandments, right? We're dealing, of course, with the sixth commandment. We've gotten back up to the top of the second tablet. And this commandment is Lo Tirzach. Okay? Lo Tirzach, thou shalt not murder. Now, this is very interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, we don't have this whole text to play with. There's no reason that's given. Maybe that's because you don't need a reason. And we'll get to that in a minute. And it's interesting that there's a very specific word that's chosen for murder, retzach. Okay? And we'll have to take a look at that, maybe. But there are a number of things that bother me. Now you would think that this is a pretty straightforward thing. I mean, the commandment says don't kill, don't murder. That's it. What's to discuss? Next. And yet there are certain things about this commandment which bother me. I remember the most obvious example that I can think of, which is that we were on this patrol one night. Yeah, I know. I'm going to get taken for a ride, right? We were on this patrol. We were doing an ambush. And I won't give you the details of the whole story because this isn't a two-hour class, right? Suffice it to say that the purpose of an ambush in this particular area was called a star ambush, a Marav Kochav. And the way that it's set up is that you get into a circle and you lie in a circle on top of some miserable hill in the middle of nowhere. And each person puts his foot on top of the next person's foot, right? Sort of, in other words, one of your feet is under someone's foot and one of your feet is over someone's foot. And the idea is, you know, that you get to this place and you're totally quiet. And when you have to pass a message around the circle, there's eight of you, so you can just tap his foot and he leans over and you whisper or whatever it might be, right? Because, you know, if you're setting up an ambush and you have intelligence that, you know, terrorists might come through a particular valley on their way to commit whatever act of terrorism they're going to commit in northern Israel, and you're trying to catch them and sort of ward them off before they get to the border, so you don't want to have a patrol that sits on top of a hill in the middle of the night in Lebanon going, psst, 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 psst. That's what you do. Anyway, someone spotted something on their shvanfan, on their SLS night vision goggles, whatever it is, because we would pass them around regularly. And you know, we went through our routine, and there's a very standard routine, and you practice this a number of times. And it only happened to be two or three times that I actually put this into practice. And this was actually the only time during that whole period that in an ambush that we actually ended up doing what it was we were supposed to do. And so, you know, there's a lot more to the story than the story tells. But suffice it to say that what you do is you sort of, once you know where they're coming from, you spread out in a line and you do what's called a makat esh, right? You all fire into the darkness, into the night. And then you switch your cartridge and you do it again. And then you disengage. And it's very different from what you do in the day. In the day, so, you know, you'll attack and you'll get into a firefight, whatever. And at least at that time, I don't know if the rules have changed since I, you know, left regular army, but in my day, so it was deemed too dangerous to conduct a normal field of operations fire mission at night because you were going down into a valley. You couldn't really see. You could get separated. They could hide. It was too dangerous. And the theory was that if you, you know, laid down accurate fire, and it wasn't just, you know, machine gun fire, it was an RPG, and it was an M203 grenade launcher, and a rocket, and a heavy machine gun, and you would, you know, sort of throw out a certain percentage of your ammunition, and you would do it twice, and then you would look to see, did you see anything moving, right? In this particular case, we spotted at least two, what we thought were bodies, we weren't sure, and then you disengage. And the theory is that the average unit is not going to continue their mission. Terrorist unit is not going to continue their mission. They're going to realize they were spotted, and they're going to take off. And then you have whatever details the rest army command does to cover this and to make sure that nobody might. And then the next morning, when you go out on your patrols at dawn, so you go back to that area, and you try to reanalyze exactly what happened, and you find footprints, and you see, did they die, or whatever. Anyway, sure enough, in the morning, we found two bodies. And they were obviously terrorists, and they were loaded for bear, and it was clear that they had been killed. And because of the situation that I was in, and because this had come over a long period of time, this wasn't this tremendously difficult experience for me, because it was sort of this void. It wasn't like you shot at someone and killed them. Nobody knew who had done the shooting. It was a very healthy way, I mean, I guess, if anything could be healthy. And maybe because of that, because there wasn't this tremendous emotional, you know, baggage that I had to deal with, as in other instances, here I could really look at it. And I remember thinking later, like, here's a guy, and he's walking through a valley, and he's convinced that he's going to heaven. Because, without going into detail, he's been promised, let's say if he's Hezbollah, that if he dies on the field of fire as a martyr in the cause of Islam, he's going straight to heaven. And I don't know if this morning you had a chance to look at what heaven means to the Muslim, right, within certain areas. But heaven looks pretty good, because all the things you can't do here, you get to do in heaven. You get lots of women and wine and song, and it's a big party. It's very different from the Jewish idea of heaven. Right? We go upstairs and we get to sit and learn Torah in heaven. Remember once a student says to me, well, then I don't want to go to heaven. You know, I'm not interested in that. Right? But maybe heaven is actually appreciating it, right? But I guess that's my idea of heaven, right? It's interesting that one person's idea of heaven is another person's idea of hell. But anyway, right? So, and I always wonder, you know, if my perspective is right, granted that's a question I won't know in this world, but if my perspective is right, so someone's going to get a big surprise when they get upstairs, right? Because his heaven is my hell, but okay, right? And I remember thinking, here's a guy, and he's walking through this valley. And he's really on, from his perspective, a sacred mission. He's out to liberate his people. He's out to protect his land. We are actually, in that point, certainly, we're occupying a part of Lebanon that the Israeli government wasn't laying claim to, simply for security concerns. What gives me the right to kill him? And even if I or my fire didn't directly kill him, and we'll never know, my order did, what gives me the right to do that? Lo tirtzach, thou shalt not murder. Now it's interesting that there are different words, and we have them in every language. There's murder, there's killing, there's death, there's massacre, right? There's retzach, which is murder, there's harigah, which is killing. So obviously there's one type of causation of death, which I'm not allowed to do. So first of all, what is that? And why is that? Because I just pointed out one side of the question. What gives me the right? Well, you could ask the opposite side of the question. Why shouldn't I have the right? In fact, in that particular instance, what gave me the right, ostensibly, getting out of the question of military command and orders and whatever else it is that I think that my life or someone's life who I'm responsible for is in danger. So therefore, I think, okay, I have a right to kill this person because someone else's life is in danger. Who says I have that right? In fact, I mentioned to you in one of our classes that there are three prohibitions that I'm not allowed to transgress, even if my life is in danger. I'm not allowed to murder somebody else, even if someone puts a gun at my head and tells me to do it, unlike most other commandments, Shabbat. I can violate Shabbat all day. Right? I can eat a pork sandwich with a cigarette in one hand, flipping light switches with the other, because somebody puts a gun to my head, but no problem. I can eat on Yom Kippur. And I can eat a sumptuous meal and invite the whole neighborhood. We can all eat if our lives are in danger. But I can't kill somebody. Why? Says the Talmud. Because there's no way of measuring whose blood is redder. In other words, what right do I have to determine that his life is more valuable than mine? So, by the same logic, I should say, well, what right do I have to say that my life isn't more valuable than his? Maybe I'm making a mistake. Maybe it is. And what the Talmud is really saying is I don't have any way of knowing. So therefore, I can't do an action which ends life. If as a result of my not doing an action that will end life, my life gets ended, that's not my problem, because that's not my action. So if that's true, then what gives me the right to do that? So the Talmud says, well, we have this concept called pikuach nefesh. Right? The saving of a life. The fakir is literally to oversee. And I have to oversee a very specific life, mine. And if my life is in danger, then I can do certain things. And the Talmud says, if somebody is coming to kill you, hashkein lahargo, you can jump up and kill him first. It doesn't say you can kill him. It says you can go run and kill him first. It's the same verb, by the way, as when Abraham arises early in the morning to take Isaac to the binding of Isaac, symbolizing this tremendous motivation to do the will of God. I am fulfilling the will of God if I kill somebody in defense of my life. If someone here, God forbid, takes a knife out and runs at me, then not only am I allowed to kill him, but I'm obligated to kill him. So how do you do that? How does that work? How do I figure this out? What really is the definition of murder? What is murder? And having said that, it's interesting that if the Bible had come along and taken pains to define this murder, then this would all make sense to me. Because there's something missing in this commandment. And that is everything. When I have the commandment of Shabbat, oh boy, do they wax and wane on Shabbat. Well, you have to remember Shabbat, and you're not supposed to do labor during the week, and don't do labor on the Sabbath, and not you, and not your animal, not your mother's animal, not your father's, brother's, uncle's, cousin's cat. Why? Well, because 6 days you created the world, and you got out of Egypt, and in order you have social equality, and all this different stuff. And then they get to murder, and says, don't murder. Yeah. Don't, what does it mean? Why? So I would have thought, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Right? Well, the reason it doesn't say anything about murder is because murder is obvious. You know, I've had many philosophical discussions in my day about defining good and evil. But I've never had to express to somebody why or why not they shouldn't murder. In fact, it's interesting. I once read an interesting book. It's Esha Torah, which is Yeshiva here, right? Has a something called the Kiruv Primer. Okay. And I have my, I think it's very important and very valuable to always perceive different people's opinions. But I have, certain differences of opinion with the methodology of logic in that particular book. But I think it's a very valuable book. But okay. And there, the perspective, if I understand it correctly, is that when one stops to listen, you can really prove that there's a God, and you can prove that the Torah is divine, and everything else. So whether my debate with that possibility is semantic or real is an interesting discussion, but let's for the moment take that as a possibility, that you could prove God. I'm not so sure, but okay, right? So one of the things that I found in there, very interesting, is it says, there is, for example, an objective ethic. Now this was very different from the way that I had always considered it. Now, as I had always considered, and we were discussing this the other day, that the atheist has a problem, because if there is no higher authority, no objective ethical authority, then essentially all ethics are relative. And therefore, if an atheist chooses to accept or desires an objective ethic, well, he's got a problem if he has no objective authority. So it comes along this book and says, no, the opposite. Everybody believes in murder. Murder is objectively wrong because everybody believes that murder is wrong. Ah, you'll tell me, right? Remember that. That's very important, right? Ah, you'll tell me that there are whole societies that murdered. Nazis murdered in Germany. He says, no, it's not true. Nazis just had a different definition of murder. If you would have walked into Nazi Germany and pulled out a pistol and shot Adolf Hitler in the head, they would have put you on trial for murder. That was their definition of murder. If you murdered somebody they didn't want you to kill, that was murder. And if you killed somebody that was okay to kill, then it wasn't murder. And this seems to be absurd. What do you mean? How could you call the killing of Adolf Hitler murder and the killing of innocent men, women, and children not murder? But the truth is, we do the same thing. We do the same thing. I define the terrorist coming through a valley. Well, him, it's okay to kill. That's not murder. But the man who pulls out a pistol and shoots his wife in an argument, he's a murderer. So how do I do this? How do I arrive at a definition? So I expect, okay, God's going to give me the Ten Commandments, right? And he's going to make it clear. And he does the opposite. Doesn't tell me at all. Doesn't tell me what murder is. Doesn't tell me why I can't murder. Doesn't tell me what murder is, what it means, what it doesn't mean, where it comes from. So if my initial question would have been, why does God have to tell me in the Ten Commandments not to murder? Right, I can understand. Now, this is a very interesting thing. The Torah has very different types of laws. Right? We tend to assume that there is a system of law, and that system of law guides us. The truth is that there are different types of laws. In fact, there are three very specific different types of laws, which I may have mentioned in our introduction to Mitzvot, but it will prove important here, so I'll re-mention it. Ah, there is peace in the world, right? And that is Chukim, Torot, and Mishpatim, or Torot and Mitzvot. There are three different types of laws. I have some laws, and I'm going to give you the working definition based on the Medrash that Rashi quotes at the beginning of the portion known as Chukat, that there are three types of laws. The first type of law is a law that I would have figured out on my own. And that's called, we'll call that a mishpat. Okay? But don't steal. Well, even if I didn't believe in God, and even if I didn't have a Torah, I probably would have figured out that it's not a good idea to steal. And in fact, all societies, secular or otherwise, right, monotheistic or polytheistic, seem to have some code that defines theft. So what the Torah gave me in telling me not to steal is difficult to understand, because I would have figured it out without the Torah, but okay. Then I have a separate second, and it makes a lot of sense to me. And I don't have to sit here and give a class explaining theft, despite the fact that that's exactly what we're going to do tomorrow, right? Because everybody understands you can't steal. And there's a second type of law. Second type of law, well, I wouldn't have come to it on my own, right? And we'll call this a Torah. I wouldn't have come to it on my own. But once the Torah tells me to do it, then it makes a lot of sense. Take, for example, Shabbat. So, I don't know if we would have come up with the idea that once a week we should take a day off and do all this weird stuff. Not do this, not do that, and then take, you know, wine and go to synagogue and all these other things that we do. But once we have Shabbat, if you stop to appreciate it, it makes a lot of sense. Not so difficult to explain to somebody that there's a beauty and the value of Shabbat. Somebody came to me, stood on one foot, and said, you know, explain to me Shabbat. So I would say, okay, I'll tell you what, and I'd pick him up, put him on my shoulders, and take him home for Shabbos. And then he'd figure it out. It's not so difficult. Whether a person wants to do anything with it, okay, that's another issue. But that someone viewing me keeping Shabbat, celebrating Shabbat, should view me as an idiot, that's not difficult. It makes sense. Okay. Then I got a third type of mitzvah. Third type of mitzvah is ridiculous. It's called a chok. In fact, the way that Rashi, based on the Medrash, defines this type of mitzvah is that there are certain type of mitzvot that the nations of the world will naturally come to when attempting to ridicule the Jewish people. Like the nations of the world, if, God forbid, they want to ridicule us, they're not going to say, what's the matter with you? Keeping Shabbos ridiculous. No. But, for example, there's a law known as the law of the red heifer. And this is one of the weirdest laws you can imagine. If you're in a tent, and you discover there's a dead body in the tent, well, this can be a harrowing experience, okay? And you may be concerned with all sorts of things. The Torah says to you, the first thing you should be concerned with is that you're now impure. Whatever that means. And you've come into contact with a dead body by virtue of being in the same room with a dead body. Or you touch a dead body. I don't know, you're running down the street one day and you trip, and lo and behold, you fall on a corpse. This can also be a harrowing experience. Says the Torah, the first thing you should be concerned with is that you're somehow spiritually impure. Now, of course, it's not just spiritual impurity, and we're going to discuss this when we get to kashrut, how that relates to keeping kosher. That's something to whet your appetite. But it's not just spiritual impurity, because the fact is that it's communicated by physical contact. If I'm spiritually impure somehow from this contact with a dead body, and I touch you, so now you're spiritually impure by virtue of secondhand contact with a dead body. So secondhand spiritual impurity isn't the same as firsthand spiritual impurity. And then you have thirdhand spiritual impurity. And it's almost like reminds you of when you were in first grade and you and your friends played cooties. You know, who gets a cootie shot and no backsies and all these other silly games. And, you know, it doesn't make much sense to me. And I look at this system and I say, this is very weird. But of course we're just beginning. Because the Torah will always give you a way to resolve these difficult situations. So the Torah says, well, what do you do if you find yourself in such a state of spiritual impurity? Because after all, now you've got a problem. Well, you can't enter the temple. And you want to enter the temple, you want to offer a sacrifice, you want to just get close and communicate, whatever. Maybe you're a priest and you have to serve in the temple, whatever it might be. You want to go to synagogue. You want to have relationships with other people. So what do you do? Well, it's very simple. Well, you wait 7 days, and then you do whatever you do, go to mikveh, whatever, right? But part of this process is that they take a red cow, and they only do this once. They take a red cow. It's got to be a perfectly red cow. There can't be two white hairs, right? In fact, Spinoza doesn't mention this one either, but he should have, right? Two white hairs. Totally invalidate this red cow. I got to find a perfectly red cow. Red hair all over. And then I take this cow, and I slaughter it, ritually slaughter it, and then I burn it. And then I take the ashes of this red cow that I've burned, and I mix it with some kind of holy water, and I take this little mixture, and I put it on your head. And now, you're no longer spiritually impure. Woohoo! Oh, and did I forget to mention that the person who is doing this sprinkling to make you physically or spiritually pure, he becomes impure. So the nations of the world look at this thing and they say, there's something seriously wrong with you people. And this makes sense. And this is a challenge. It's called a chok. And there are other laws like this, maybe not quite as obvious, but they're also called chukim. For example, the laws of kashrut. Right, I take a little piggy, and I decide that for some reason if I eat that little piggy, I'm going to be, I don't know what, spiritually impure, I don't know. So I don't eat pigs. And if I take a perfectly good piece of kosher meat, and I take a perfectly good piece of kosher cheese, and I mix them together, all of a sudden, I'm eating unkosher, and that's horrible, and the punishment is severe, and whatever else it is. Why? Didn't your mommy tell you it all gets mixed up inside anyway? So what does this mean? So that's a chok. And there are different types of laws. Now, I would expect to find in the Torah a commandment of a chok. In other words, if there is some value, and people very often, when it comes to this type of an almost ridiculous, seemingly, mitzvah, people make a mistake and they think that that's a challenge to me, that this is the type of mitzvah that affords me the opportunity to show that I act as a Jew simply because I believe in God. In other words, that I'm not fulfilling a commandment because I understand it, but I'm fulfilling a commandment simply out of faith. And there's, And there's no value to my attempting to understand it. In fact, that's not so true. Maimonides discusses this. The Sefer HaChinuch, Book of Knowledge, discusses this. Many other authorities discuss this. And they say that that's a big mistake. It's true that I fulfill this commandment because I've been told to fulfill it, if that's my perception. But I have to try to understand it. And we mentioned this in our introduction to mitzvot. If I don't understand the mitzvah, then how can I possibly hope to have it affect me ethically in the way that it could if I do understand it? So I have to try to understand it. So I would expect that that type of mitzvah, a chok, that that would be in the Torah. That would make sense to me. Because there's no way that I'm going to keep kosher if it's not somewhere in the Torah. And never mind this whole red F of impurity, garbage, narishkeit, I don't know what it is. But it's in the Torah. Okay, if I believe in Torah, I'm going to do it. I can even understand if Torot are in the Torah. You know, I don't know if we keep Shabbat, whatever, fine. But we have a written tradition, and we have an oral tradition. I would at least say that something like Lo Tirtzach, thou shalt not murder, it doesn't really need to be in there. I mean, belief in God, idols, which has to do with passion, Shabbat, even respecting your parents, I can understand. Because even though if you ask anybody to give you an example of a logical commandment, they'll quote to you at some point respecting your parents. You could also ask all those people who come to it quite easily and logically whether they think they fully fulfill it. And they'll tell you no. So I can understand that, but not to murder. I mean, when was the last time any of you were worried about murdering? You know, I mean, there's certain halachot that we all have a problem with, and we work on them. But, you know, I don't consider it a tremendous, you know, I mean, if you think about it, we've all fulfilled this commandment while sitting in this room. Nobody murdered while we're in this room. Right? So we've all fulfilled a commandment. In fact, we fulfilled all kinds of commandments while we sat in this room. Right? Nobody in the last 20 minutes ate unkosher food. Nobody adultered. Nobody murdered. Hopefully nobody stole, unless my examples are stealing your time. Right? And, you know, all sorts of other things. I mean, this seems to me to be a waste of time. It's almost as though the Torah presents it in a two-word phrase, because like, you know what? We got to stick this in there, but you don't really need to spend any time on it, because it's obvious. So, you know, Lo Tirtzach. You shouldn't murder. Okay. Lo tignov, don't steal. Okay. Lo tinaf, don't adulter. Okay. And now let's get serious again. I mean, is that the Ten Commandments? It doesn't make sense to me. What is this doing here? Why do I need this? By the way, interesting question. What else is missing Now here you might want to open up your Bible. Take a moment. I'll be really surprised if somebody catches this. But there's something very major missing from the second set of the five commandments. In other words, the last five, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Something major that's missing. Take a look at them. And it begins in verse 13, and you can see how the word is, it's like staccato, you know, lo tirzach, lo tiraf, lo tignam, right? What's missing? Just look at verse 13 and 14. That's the last five commandments. Well, we'll see. Bearing false testimony, I think, has a lot to do with lying, even though it's phrased as testimony. We'll have to get to discussing why it doesn't just say lo tishaker, don't lie. It's a good question. Something a little more obvious that I would have expected to find.
It doesn't even mention God.
I don't find God here. There is no mention of the name of God in these last five commandments. The previous ones, they're all about God. I am God. Don't worship idols because I'm God. I'm the God that's going to get you if you do. Don't carry God's name in vain because I'm a wrathful, vengeful, jealous, achweisnish God. All of a sudden, now God, I don't know, you know, he made his point, and now, like, deal with the... So it's interesting that we're now in the second stage, which is between me and my fellow human being. But I still expect to see the name of God. How come God isn't there? So there's a beautiful, beautiful medrash. I believe it's in the Psikta Rabbati. And the medrash gives an interesting example. It says that this was the question... Now, I love this. I love this so much. The medrash chooses to bring me this tale as a question asked by Hadrian to Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina. Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina was one of the great, great Torah scholars and leaders of his generation in the period, really, during and following the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. Hadrian was the one who was responsible for the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. Bar Kokhba Rebellion is 131 to 135 CE. The estimates are unclear. It's very difficult to get an accurate number, but we're talking about somewhere between 2 and 4 million Jews were murdered in the space of 4 years. Of course, whether they're murdered or not will depend on our definition. And the final showdown between the warriors of Bar Kokhba, Shimon Bar Kaziva, in a city called Beitar, and the Roman armies, was an incredible bloody affair. Talmud says that if you look at the last section of the biblical part of the grace after meals, so there's an additional blessing that the rabbis add. It's called Hatov V'Hamitiv. God is good, and God does good. And the Talmud expresses to me what this blessing and when this blessing was at. It's a very weird story. When Beitar fell, it's not so clear how many. There may have been as many as 1.5 million Jews who were murdered. Hadrian's legions run through the city. He is determined to destroy every last vestige, everything of Jewish independence, of Jewish dreams of future freedom and domination, of a Jewish empire returning one day to this part of the region. It is Hadrian, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, who renames this city, Aeopolis and Capitolina, and removes even any trace of the name Jerusalem, which has Jewish vestige. It's Hadrian who forbids Jews to even walk on the Cardo, in that street in the old city. And it's Hadrian who attempts to wipe out any possibility of Jewish independence, and so his legions don't take any prisoners. They kill the entire army. 1.5 million Jews are butchered. The Talmud says that the massacre was so great that the blood from Beitar ran all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, and that the shores were filled with blood. And it's interesting, by the way, that the city of Beitar, which is not that far from Efrat, when you're in Efrat for Shabbat, if you remind me, I'll show you where it is, where the ruins are, or on the tour next Tuesday, if you remind me. It's in the hills. In the hills, in the Judean hills. And the sea is off to the west, and it's downhill all the way. And it doesn't matter to me whether the blood actually ran all the way to the sea. The imagery suggests what a massacre it must have been. That was Hadrian. And Hadrian wouldn't let them bury the bodies. For 18 years, I think it was. And finally the Jews somehow arrange and allowed, some believe through Rebbe, who became close with the Emperor of Rome, Antoninus. And they came to Beitar, finally they were allowed in to bury all these bodies. You can imagine what it must have been like to bury all these bodies. And to bury them after so much time, and they found all the bodies were fresh. There was no decomposition. They could identify each one and give each one a grave, etc. And this was this tremendous miracle. And the miracle was so great because these bodies were a symbol of the fact that that Jewish independence was lost forever, that there was no hope. And in that symbol, God chose, if this is a literal miracle in the Talmud, to remind the Jewish people that it was not lost. That no matter what Hadrian would do, it would never be lost. As long as the Jewish people still had faith. As long as they still wanted to bury their dead. And had respect for their past. Very powerful idea. And so we make a blessing in the Birkat HaMazon, in the grace after meals. This was Hadrian. So the Medrash says, Hadrian comes to Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina and he asks him a question. About the Ten Commandments, I love this. You know, I love this. It's like Adolf Hitler, he was studying the Gemara in Shabbat, and he had an interesting question. I mean, if you know the history of it, it's absurd. So it's not accidental that this question is asked by Hadrian, who is the murderer par excellence. So Hadrian says, how come there's no mention of the name of God in the last five of your Ten Commandments? So again, whether he's asking this literally, there's a tremendous message that's being said here. So what does Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina answer him? He says, well, I'll give you an example that you can relate to. When a great emperor dominates and establishes his dominion, so he puts up signs and statues to himself all over the kingdom, right? And Hadrian indeed put up idols of himself and, you know, pictures and whatever, all over the kingdom. But he doesn't put it in the outhouse. Nobody puts in, you know, you don't sign your name, you know, you don't put a plaque if somebody wants to donate money. So we need another bathroom here. I think you've come to realize that. But if somebody came and said, I'd like to donate money to something you need, I wouldn't say, could you donate a new toilet? You know, the Goldberg toilet. It wouldn't, now when you think about it, it's very important. And as a matter of fact, every person who ever came down and saw a plaque there while he was sitting on the toilet would bless this person, thanking him for the toilet. But you wouldn't do it. So it's the same thing. It's like there's something that's toilety about these last commandments. It just smacks of man's mistakes. So God doesn't want to be involved. So God leaves his name out of it. As if to say, this is not me. This is your problem. That's what the Medrash says. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, how do I understand that? What's going on here? Why is God's name left out of the last of these commandments? And go a stage further. Because if I ask you, why do we need it? So this question has a double implication. See, these commandments are part of a system that was given to the Jewish people at Sinai. Am I right? And therefore it makes complete and utter sense to me that the mitzvah of Shabbat is included in the Ten Commandments. Because, you know, the non-Jewish world, according to Jewish tradition, is not obligated to celebrate Shabbat. But that's not true for murder. The non-Jewish world is very much obligated to fulfill the prohibition against murder. So why is this given as a separate commandment to the Jewish people? And by the way, go a stage further. How do I know that the non-Jewish world is commanded to fulfill the prohibition against murder? They might know. Oh, it's in the seven laws that were given to Noah after the flood, which at least according to Jewish tradition are an obligation on every non-Jew. It's very interesting that within the Jewish tradition there is also a system of obligation or opportunity to develop a relationship with God for a non-Jew. Right? The relationship with God is not limited to your becoming a Jew, to becoming a Christian, to becoming a Muslim. It takes on a different form if you're a Jew, which is very different from some other religions in the world, by the way, just as an aside. And so, therefore, these laws are given to the sons of Noah. And there are seven of them. You're not allowed to murder. You're not allowed to steal. You're not allowed to adulter. Idolatry. False testimony. Cruelty to animals. Very strange that that's in there. That's a discussion in and of itself. Right? We'll get to that when we discuss kashrut, I hope. And setting up a system of law. A system of courts. And it doesn't matter what that system of law comes up with. That you have a system of law. Those are the seven Noahide laws. So God's already told the entire world not to murder. How come he has to tell the Jewish people again? That doesn't make sense. This is repetition par excellence, and I want to understand this. Now, having said this, and by the way, let me just add one last point before we have some fun. There are two separate groupings here, right? So try to clear your minds for a moment of everything you learned this last week and a half. And imagine that you were coming on your first day to Israelite. Because I would be amazed if this question has not arisen at some point. I'm sure it's arisen in my class. I mean, I'm not thinking about it right now. But and you've got two units. My relationship with God and my relationship with my fellow human being. Which would you think should come first? Very interesting. And by the way, I'll prove to you which should come first halakhically. But what do you? Which do you think should come first, and why? In other words, first I have to develop a relationship with my fellow human being before I can develop a relationship with God. That's what you're saying. And by the way, that's reflected halakhically. On Yom Kippur, I can do repentance for the transgressions that affected my relationship with God. But I can't do repentance for the transgressions that are affected by my relationship with my fellow human being until I ask my fellow human being forgiveness. And the Talmud goes a stage further and says that God won't forgive me until man does. If I'm a thief, I can't repent before God. First, I have to go to my fellow human being and repent before him. Who did I steal from? And then I can go to God. So I would expect Ben Adam L'Chaviro to come first. My relationship with my fellow human being to come first. Why do I start with Ben Adam L'Makom? Why do I start with my relationship with God and then I get to my relationship with my fellow human being? It's very strange. So I want to suggest to you an interesting direction. And I got to tell you that this direction is going to leave you with the, I guess, responsibility, if you choose to follow this pattern of thought, to go further. Because there's a limit to how much we can cover in one class, right? And this topic is covered a lot in the next course, but I still think it's very important to get into this. But before we do that, let's talk about murder. So what is murder? What do you think murder is? If you could define it, there are certain acts and instances that we would agree are definitely murder, right? And we all have that image in our heads. And there are certain acts that we would agree are definitely not murder, and we have that image in our heads, right? So how would I define murder? Very interesting. If I take a machine gun, and I go into a school building in Ireland, and I kill 20-some-odd children, then everybody agrees I'm a murderer. That's simple, right? And if I'm one of those school children, and I happen to have a knife, and I kill that murderer as he's coming in, then I'm not a murderer. And that's very simple. What about if I have the opportunity to subdue that person in Ireland, and I choose to kill him? Am I a murderer then? Is my definition of murder any time I don't have to take a life to save a life? Go a stage further. Because the line is so blurred. Imagine that you're walking down the street and, you know, you're gazing at shop windows. You look through a window, right? And you see like four or five guys with masks on. And they're surrounding this helpless individual and they're plunging knives into his body and blood is everywhere. And you burst through this glass, you know, you become Superman, right? I mean, this guy is being butchered. And you burst through this glass, right? And only then do you hear the music of ER, and you realize you're in an emergency room, and they're all doctors, and they're operating on a guy to save his life. So my image is never enough. In fact, I'll give you an extreme example. I had a sensei a long time ago, and he once told us a story. He was describing this very, he was discussing this very issue. In terms of the obligation of the, you know, use of knowledge and use of force or whatever. He was once walking up, and this was a guy, you have to understand, he was an incredible individual. He was into yoga and karate, all sorts of other things. But those two I know he was very, very into, and he was very advanced in both of them. And he could do things with his body that would just like make me nauseous, you know, like put his legs and arms in all sorts of weird positions. And he had a round kick that would just float up in the air forever. Anyway, he was walking up near Yeshiva University once, which is not a great neighborhood, and he sees these three guys beating the heck out of this other guy. And he, you know, I mean, this guy's hands are like registered as deadly weapons. So he figures, okay, this is an opportunity to put what he knows to some use. So he, you know, runs across the street and proceeds to beat the heck out of these three guys who are beating the heck out of this guy. What transpires, and this guy who's like, you know, limping, whatever, manages to get away from these three guys because he took them on. What transpired was that he had mugged these three guys. And they had overcome him, and they were beating him up. And so he had saved the mugger. So it's a gray area. So I want to tell you how the Talmud, how tradition looks at this gray area. Very interesting. Because we have a very specific image of murder. You remember that I told you that somehow, if the Ten Commandments is an introduction to the entire Torah, then each commandment is a gate that opens up allusions to all sorts of other issues. So listen to some of the examples of what the Talmud chooses to call murder. So the Talmud in the Tractate of Bava Metzia in 58b, and this is actually very much connected to a Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers, says an interesting thing. The Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers says, Lo yalbin pnei chaviro berabim. A person shouldn't embarrass his fellow man in public. We take these things for granted. I remember once when I noticed that my students, you know, there are different types of humor. There's humor where you laugh with somebody, and there's humor when you laugh at somebody. If the only thing you can do to be funny is to do it at somebody else's expense, that's not so funny. And sometimes, you know, you sort of get into it, you know, cut down humor, you cut each other down. It's not really such a healthy thing to do. And the most unhealthy thing about it is how easy it is to embarrass somebody without realizing it. Says the Mishnah, what happens if you embarrass somebody? What happens if you embarrass somebody? This is unbelievable. This is unbelievable! Listen to this! If you embarrass somebody, says the Mishnah, you lose your portion in the world to come. It doesn't say this about many things. It doesn't say it about stealing. It doesn't say it about eating pig. It doesn't say it about smoking in your car on Yom Kippur afternoon. But if you embarrass your fellow human being, you lose your portion in the world to come. And the Talmud of Bava Metzia says an unbelievable thing. Why does it say Yalbin? Why is it called the Halbin? The Halbin doesn't mean to embarrass. It means to whiten a person. Literally, l'halbin pnei chaviro, to whiten a person's face. Because what happens when you embarrass somebody? So the blood drains from their face. So says the Talmud, when you allow the blood to drain from somebody's face, you're guilty of murder. It's a form of character assassination. That, says the Talmud, is equivalent to murder. You can murder somebody with your tongue just as easily as you can murder them with a knife. And the Talmud goes further. There's an unbelievable verse in Dvarim, in chapter 22, verse 26. This is, I won't go into all the specifics of the case, but it's talking about a case of rape. If someone is betrothed and I force myself upon her and I rape her. V'lanara lo taseh davar. So the girl, she's guiltless, right? And she has no sin, right? Because this person forced himself upon her. Now that's a very powerful line, by the way, because in that society, and we know this in certain codes, for example, the Hammurabi, we find reference to the fact that if a woman is spoiled, if she's not a virgin, then that alone makes her culpable. Because the issue is not how it happened, but what happened. So she bears guilt for having allowed herself to become a virgin. You know, the whole defense, you know, that a rapist will use, that she brought it upon herself. What did she wear, and did she ask for it, etc.? So the Torah, 3,000 years ago, perceives this possibility and in one sentence wipes it out. The girl, you don't do anything to, she has no sin. She's done nothing. It's his fault. Ki kasher yakum ish al reihu, just as a person will arise against his neighbor, urtzachon nefesh, and will kill him, Kein hadavar hazeh. So is this. In other words, it equates this cape of rape with murder. It's not my responsibility that you're killing me. Right? In other words, if you think about it, I don't know if they've ever tried this in court, but if you think about it, if I can suggest that the reason a woman is raped is because she asked for it, well then the reason a person is murdered is because he asked for it. And there's no limit to it. So the Torah says, rape is like murder. So it's interesting. What is it about rape that makes it like murder? This woman's life will never be the same. She will never be the same woman. She's lost a part of herself and a part of her life that she can never regain. It's an incredible thing. And as much as you can try, and I've had the unfortunate experience of counseling women who've been raped, and you know that there's just a limit to how much you can do for a person. There's a part of them that was taken away. And that's murder. Because murder means I'm taking someone's life. I'm taking their potential. I'm taking this woman's potential. So that's murder too. You also have to bear in mind that the issue is not that he's allowed to, but does he have an obligation to? In other words, within that society, if the whole issue was now that the woman was spoiled, in other words, that she lost her virginity or whatever it was, and she's known now as a rape victim, you know, in Judaism there's a whole system of reparations. System of payment of damages is a fascinating system. I told a few of you after class one day, there's no system of jail. I don't put somebody in jail. Jail is not a, it's certainly not viewed in the Bible as valuable. It's meaningless to take somebody and lock him up. Except for one particular instance, and that's a separate story. Right? But I have to make reparations. How do I make reparations? There's certain things you can't ever repay. And yet the Bible still says you have to do it. You have to find a way to do it because this person deserves restitution. So there are five basic categories that I have to figure out value for in terms of restitution. Embarrassment. Do I cause embarrassment to a person? I have to pay for a person's embarrassment. I have to pay for a person's loss of work. I have to pay for physical damage. Right? There are different types of categories. So in this particular case, this girl, right, it's going to be harder for her to get married. I have to pay for the fact that she now can't as easily get married. And therefore this guy, if she wants, has an obligation to take her as his wife. Now what that means and how that works, and you know, you have to also remember that we're dealing with a system that was completely different from what we're used to in modern society, so that's a longer discussion, right? But it's a very good question. Okay, now, getting back to this. So rape is murder? Go a stage further, right? The Abarbanel, says an unbelievable thing. He quotes, I couldn't find the Abarbanel. He quotes it from somewhere in the Talmud, and I don't remember where it is. I have an idea, but I know the Abarbanel says it. I'll quote him, Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. He says, if you withhold tzedakah, if you withhold charity from someone who's poor, you are guilty of murder. Now, it may not be the same murder in terms of, you know, if someone's guilty of murder, you put them to death. But it's equated with murder. It's a type of murder. Why? Because that charity is that person's lifeline. And if I withhold that from him, I'm murdering him. I'm destroying his life. If I cause someone to lose their livelihood, that's equated with murder. You know, there's an interesting halakha, right? What do you think of when you open up a store? What's your big question when you open up a store? Will your store make money? Judaism is a whole different perspective. What's the first thing you have to think of when you open up a store is who else is going to lose money? Like, you wouldn't think of that. The issue is, can I profit? What do I care if somebody else loses money? I'm not allowed to open up, let's say, a vegetable store next door to a vegetable store that's already open. I don't know, I'm sure somewhere in your past experiences you've come across this type of thing where there's like four different garages next to each other or 19 different supermarkets all next to each other. So halakha doesn't allow this. It's a very interesting question. And this question came up in Efrat. They opened up a vegetable store downstairs and there was a supermarket there already and the supermarket sold vegetables and then the upstairs supermarket also started selling vegetables and they came to Rabbi Riskin and they had a whole din Torah and a whole discussion. I won't get into all the technical details of how that works, right? If this particular store that's already open cannot provide for everyone's needs, then another store has the right to open. There's a different, you know, issues that arise. But if I take away someone's livelihood, I'm guilty of murder. I'm destroying their life. Tremendous idea. The Gemara in Sota, and this is one that I took very seriously. There's an unbelievable Talmudic discussion in Sota. In attracting. And it's based on a verse in the Proverbs. Listen to this. I remember studying this as I was learning in Yeshiva, and I actually came across it today again. But I saw it when I was learning to be a rabbi. You know, one of the biggest challenges of being a rabbi is that on the one hand, in order to ordain somebody as a rabbi, in whatever system you're being ordained, so you're essentially giving them the opportunity, the responsibility, to rule on halakhic rulings. You know, it's technically speaking, someone, somewhere, has signed a document, in my case, let's say the chief rabbi of Israel, that he says, based on the suggestion of the tests and whatever else I took, and the opinions of those who oversaw me, that I'm capable of ruling halakhically. Now, I know I'm not, but that's not the issue, right? So that's an awesome responsibility. So listen to how awesome that responsibility is. There's a verse in the book of Proverbs, Mishlei, the 7th chapter, verse 26. Ki rabim chalalim hipila. She has cast down many corpses. Ve'atzumim kol harugaya. And the number of her slain victims is enormous. So the Talmud says in Sotah, what is this talking about? She has cast down many corpses. This deals with a case of a student who is not really ready to render a halachic decision, who doesn't know enough, and yet chooses to do so, thus rendering a wrong decision. And what does the second stage deal with? And the number of her slain victims is enormous. This is the Talmud Chacham, this is the tremendous Torah scholar who has the capability to render a halachic decision and chooses not to. In other words, one, right, is guilty of somehow a crime actively, and one is guilty of a crime passively. Now, what does this mean? Well, if in Judaism, Torah is not just an intellectual pursuit, but it's a lifeline. If Torah is the way I live my life, then it means everything to me. If Rabbi Akiva is correct that a Jew without Torah is like a fish without water, then if I somehow distance a person from that Torah, I'm essentially causing some form of spiritual death. That's awesome. If somebody asks me a question, and I happen to believe, but I have no proof for this whatsoever, and I've never found a source for this, but I'm sure they're there. I happen to believe that this refers not only to a halachic question, if somebody asks me whether the meat is kosher, but a philosophical, ethical, moral question as well. If somebody asks me advice, they're dealing with a particular issue in Judaism, and they ask me advice, and I give them the wrong advice, I bear responsibility for the fruit of that advice. If somebody comes and sits in my office and says that they're considering seriously having a relationship with a non-Jew, let's say, and I give them the wrong advice, for all I know, there could be generations and generations of children who never see the beauty of Judaism. And therefore, the spiritual death that could, it doesn't always necessarily mean so, that could cause is my responsibility. That's awesome. But the second half is even more incredible. Because the natural inclination in such an instance is to say, well, I'll never give advice. Then I'm safe. Comes along the Talmud and says, no, don't think you're going to get off the hook. Because if you can give advice and you don't, you're just as guilty. If a guy sits in your office and he's not sure what to do and how to develop a relationship with God, and you have an idea that could help him, but you're afraid to give it to him, and you don't give it to him, then you're just as guilty. Because he forever will never have the opportunity, maybe, to gain that beauty, and his children won't gain that beauty, and his great-grandchildren, and all down history. And how much spiritual death will you be responsible? So life isn't easy. And I got news for you. Because I've alluded to this here. I don't believe that this is true just for someone who takes upon themselves somehow a role as a Jewish educator, or by the way, and I'm sure this in some ways applies not just to Judaism, but it's for anybody who has a sense of that. If you decide, and it's not for me to decide, but if you decide that there's some value to something, I mean, let's take it to an extreme. If you're a Buddhist priest, and you know that there's this tremendous truth, this beauty in the world, and you discover it through Buddhism, and although I may personally be of the opinion that there may be things in Judaism that one can discover that one can't discover in other religions, that may be. I can't know that because I'd have to know all the other religions, but maybe that's true. But I'm sure that it's true that there are beauties you can find in Judaism you can find in other religions, right? If that Buddhist priest has the opportunity to share that knowledge with someone and to give them that beauty and doesn't do so, then perhaps he's also guilty of the same thing. It's an awesome responsibility. So if you walk away from a program like this and you see that something is beautiful, you've discovered something, and you have the opportunity to share that with someone and you don't, perhaps this applies to you as well. It's an awesome responsibility. If you have insights, if you study psychology and you have psychological insights that could help a person develop a healthy relationship and you don't share that, and that person ends up not having such a healthy relationship, do you bear some form of responsibility? Judaism doesn't just teach that you're responsible for your actions, but for your inactions as well. It's a tremendous idea. Murder does not have to be an act. Murder can be the lack of an act. It's an incredible thought. Now I'm going to give you an extreme one. This one blew my mind. And it took me a while to figure out what I think makes sense to me. I'm not 100% convinced. You'll have to decide if it makes sense to you. But this one's wild. You ready for this one? And by the way, I'm just giving you a few. I mean, the list is endless. The Talmud in Sota says an unbelievable thing. This is on page 55b. If you're a host, if I have a guest over to my house, and I don't provide him with food, with sustenance, with lodging that he needs, then my act, again, is equated with murder. That's an unbelievable one. What does that mean? So the Talmud gets a little more specific. It's worse than you think. Because I would have thought, okay, a guy comes to my door, and he says, listen, I'd really like to stay in. I invite him in, and they say, listen, but I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you any food. And we sit down to dinner, and I say, look, you know, I don't have the money. You know, but if you want to sit in the living room, that's fine. And then he says, okay, but I'm really tired. Can I go to bed? I see you have a guest room. And I say, nah, you know what? No, I really don't feel like making the bed. But you're welcome to, you know, just stand in the corner over there, right? So if I do that, I'm guilty somehow of murder. Okay, that's a little difficult. Maybe if because he didn't eat and because he didn't sleep, he goes out the next day and has a car accident, that's my fault, I could see. But that's not what the Talmud is saying. Talmud says, if I don't provide him with food and escort when he leaves my house, then that act is equated with murder. Now, I realize I'm taking somewhat of a risk in saying this because you're all coming to Efrat in 2 weeks. I don't have the money to give you, you know, 6 weeks worth of food while you're in Israel when you leave the house. But this is obviously very difficult. I mean, I want to understand what this means. How could it be that my responsibility to my guest extends to such an extreme and that it's equated with murder? So now I want to tell you an unbelievable thing. This is just incredible. You want to appreciate the beauty of the Jewish legislative system of the Torah? I'm going to give you a case that will blow your mind. And this case is a fascinating case. The name of the case, you know, it's like, did you ever open up a book of legal torts, you know, law book, whatever? Sometimes the names of the case are just fascinating. You know, just like full of humor. Well, here's an example, okay? Egla Arufa literally means, by implication, calf neck hacked. Okay? In other words, the calf whose neck is hacked. That's the case. Now, what's the case? If I find a body out in the field somewhere, someone has been murdered. There's a big debate whether it's only talking about a case that's obviously murder or a case that I can't assume isn't murder, but okay, someone's dead. So what do you do in our society? So there's a body, so you call the police. We don't do that. What does the Jewish tradition do? And this is based, you can look this up, I urge you to look this up, okay? In Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 4, okay? Read this, it's incredible. So the first thing that's done is the Sanhedrin. The Jewish court is notified. The Sanhedrin immediately dispatches 5 judges to the area, even if it's Shabbat, and even if those judges have to travel Libriut on Shabbat, immediately. You know what they do? They do the most unbelievably weird thing. They start to take measurements. They take measurements from the body to the nearest city. And then the nearest city, they find the court, the Beit Din, the high court of that city. And that high court has to begin investigating. Now, if they can't find anyone responsible for that murder, then they do a very weird thing. They take a calf, it has to be under 2 years old. They take it to an unplowed field that's never been worked. And they cut the calf's head off. And this is a little weird, don't you think? So there's one line in there that gives us an idea of what this whole weird ceremony is. The rabbis, this court, have to say, Yadeinu, our hands did not spill this blood. Now that's a very strange law. The strangest thing about that law is the fact that the last people in the world that I would assume are responsible for this death are the rabbis of that court. So how come they have to do this? So the Talmud says an unbelievable thing. The Talmud says a calf, which has never borne fruit, it's never had a child, is taken to a field, which has never been plowed, which has never produced fruit. And its neck is cut to symbolize that it never will produce fruit. As a form of atonement for this life and all the fruit that that life has to offer that will never be reached. And who goes to do this? The leadership of that community. Why? Because if a murder occurs on your borders, then you, as a community, bear a certain level of responsibility. That's this law. I can't sit by and say it wasn't me. Because it is me. Because if my community was a perfect community, then this couldn't happen in my community. So the whole concept of Egla Arufa means that I, as a community, take responsibility for the fact that a murder occurred on my borders. That's why they're measuring which community has to deal with this. And everything stops. The whole city stops. Everything stops. And the court gets up from its cases, and it doesn't matter what those cases are. And even if it's on Shabbat, everything to deal with this issue. In other words, I bear responsibility for what happens in my home and around my home. And so essentially, when I escort my guest out of my house, have I ensured that justice and righteousness will prevail beyond my borders? So what is murder? What does murder really mean? What's the problem with murder? Well, the truth is that the problem is to be found in the beginning of Genesis. If you look in Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, so the Bible says it very clearly. God comes to Noah, and God says to Noah, this is on page 9, Shofech dam ha'adam, he who spills the blood of man, bi'adam damo yishafech, through man shall his blood be poured. Ki betzelem Elohim asa et ha'adam. Because man is created in the image of God. If I can kill another human being, then there is obviously something lacking in my relationship with God. That's clear. But do I understand that God is that man? That man is a world? That man is a community? Do I bear a responsibility for that community? The reason that Ben Adam Lamakom, that my relationship with God comes before my relationship with man, is precisely why I have to repeat in the Ten Commandments given to the Jewish people this law again. Because the Jewish perception of murder is different. It depends on my relationship with God. One of the seven Noahide laws is not to worship idolatry, but not to believe in God. A secular, atheistic Noahide is well within the bounds of the Noahide laws. Not so a Jew. A Jew has a problem. It's not so simple. The first commandment. My relationship with my fellow human being, my ethical development, depends ultimately on my development with my relationship with God. Because the reason that I don't murder is not just because I'm told not to. It's because I can't. It's because if I have a relationship with God and I understand my value as a human being and that I am a world, then how could I possibly not see the value of that other world, that other human being? And that's how I define murder. My definition of murder is that I have to so have developed a relationship with my world that anything which affects that world, anything which would allow me to destroy someone else's world, even an embarrassing remark at a table, is tantamount to murder. And the only way that I can commit such an act is if my act is not out of an attempt or a callous lack of thought regarding the destruction of another's world, but rather if it is an act which is wholly involved in the saving of a world, such as an ambush on a lonely hill in Lebanon. That's the understanding of Lo Tirtzach. That's what it means. And that's why you need this commandment separately above and beyond. And that's why it follows the first five commandments. And that's why God's name isn't mentioned here. Because God's name doesn't have to be mentioned here. The definition of these acts are that God's name isn't there if you can do them. People sometimes ask me, how could I say that religion, belief in God, is an ethical system? How many, over how much time, have committed how many heinous acts in the name of God? But that's the whole point. That's not God. If you can murder in the name of God, then you don't have a relationship with God. Then something's wrong. And that's the balance. So I wish that we had more time to really delve into this. There was a lot more to say. But as I mentioned at the beginning, if I've whet your appetite with regards to this topic, and if you now appreciate the two simple words in the Ten Commandments open up a floodgate with regards to a whole perception of Torah in Judaism, well, then yours is the earth.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.